Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. On today's show, we'll be picking Wisden's Test Team of the 90s, only taking into account performances from January the 1st, 1990 to 31st December, 1999. I'm Yaz Rana, and picking that team today is the Editor-in-Chief of the Wisden Cricket Monthly Magazine, new magazine out next week, Phil Walker. How's it going, Phil?
Yeah, not bad, thank you, on a Friday night. Cracking into my Wisden embossed beers that have been released in the last couple of days.
Yeah, don't worry, we'll be spending plenty of time talking about them later in the show. We've got the Editor-at-Large of Wisden Cricket Monthly, John Stern. How's it going, John?
Yeah, very well. Thank you, yes.
And our very special guest, a man with 100 test caps, 16 test hundreds, and coming to us live from South Africa over Zoom, where he is with the England white ball squad at the moment, Graham Thorpe. Graham, thanks a lot for joining the show. How's the trip going so far?
Well, it's gone well. You know, we're 3-4 days in. We've had 3 very good days of practice, and we've got our inter-squad match tomorrow, hopefully leading up to the first T20 game on next Friday.
How are you and the players finding bubble life? Some of the guys, particularly the guys who went out to the IPL, they've been in bubbles pretty much non-stop since the start of June.
Yeah, it's different, and the fact that I think what every player would say, not necessarily being able to have families, potentially being able to come and travel and see them, is something they have to get used to. But at the same time, I think they understand the responsibilities of what we're all trying to do, which is keep cricket out there, support the cricket bodies, which are hosting matches as well, and trying to get it safely through and complete these tours. I mean, we were very fortunate in the summer in England to get the amount of cricket which we did. And as I say, a different environment for players to get their heads around. But I think if you speak to a lot of players, they understand that it's their jobs, the same as us as coaching them. It's our jobs, which we love doing. But we're doing it in a slightly different way. And I think that, as you've probably seen, we're quite aware of the amount of cricket which some of our players are playing and how we have to manage them through this period during the COVID situation.
Just coming in here, Graham, watching Jofra during the IPL, I mean, we all knew that he was a superstar, and he's obviously already done some amazing things, not just for our team, but around the world. But it seemed like he'd almost moved up another level during the IPL when he was going to barely a tick over a run of ball and was cleaning up the best of the best, and they were barely hanging on against him. It looked like a test match when he was bowling from time to time.
And obviously, I watched quite a fair amount of that cricket, actually, from the IPL. And Jofra in particular, you know, a lot of the information coming back was that some of the teams, you know, were wary of taking him on because they knew his ability to take wickets in those first two overs. So, he performed magnificently in that tournament. You might say that he's further down the line is development in a way in white ball cricket. You know, we know we have an absolute top-notch fast bowler. He came into the World Cup squad, you know, and it was quite obvious that, you know, it didn't take too many people to think, should we be picking this guy? As you say, he bowled the super over it, you know, in a World Cup final. That's how much he was trusted and the level of his skill. So he's a player who we know we have to look after. We'd love his development to continue as well in the Red Bull game as well. And we have to work very closely with him and manage him as a player as well. But he's, as you can imagine, a very valued member of our squad.
On the Red Bull thing with Jofra, what does he really need to do, Graham, do you think? Because his stats still bear up very, very strongly. He didn't have the greatest of summers last year, but considering he's just getting going really with the Red Bull, what do you think he needs to do in order to get the Red Bull stuff up to the world-class level that he's already at with the white ball?
Well, continue to play. I mean, sometimes because of the impact he's had on the game so quickly in his career, sometimes expectations can become very, very high. And from our perspective, we really want him to just continue. I mean, often the speeds get mentioned with his bowling, which I hear at times. And probably the most important thing in Test cricket at times is accuracy. As we'll probably discuss some of our bowlers in this podcast tonight, accuracy is one of the things, you know, which the best bowlers have always had. And that would probably be his biggest thing, really, as a fast bowler in Red Bull cricket, to become a very accurate fast bowler as well. And to do that, you have to play. You know, if you look at some of the cricketers over the years who have become world-class players in, you know, all formats, and Red Bull cricket in particular, they're very accurate bowlers. They continue to build pressure on batsmen, and actually they don't allow them to score runs, and that's a starting point. So that would be his biggest development, you know, as a Red Bull cricketer. But I'm sure with more games under his belt, and the more comfortable he feels, and also managing him as a player, and the amount of overs he actually bowls as well, will be the key factor going forward with him, I think.
No, I think we're all really looking forward to the resumption of international cricket, particularly in lockdown 2.0. Well, let's crack on with our 11 then. So as I mentioned at the top, we're only taking into account performances from January the 1st, 1990 to December 31st, 1999. A few rules for the team. We need at least 4 frontline bowlers. We need a wicketkeeper. And I need you guys to pick a captain for me by the end. Let's start at the top. Graham, who are your openers and why have you gone for them?
So I've gone at the top. My two openers are Alex Stewart and Sachin Tendulkar.
Interesting.
Well, I wanted, obviously, I'm generally a coach who likes my players to be able to put bowlers under pressure. So in Alec, in that period, and obviously I played a lot with him, and when he opened the batting, he was somebody, if you bowl a bad ball to him, it generally went to the boundary. And so from that perspective, and he was highly respected against playing against fast bowling through his career. And his record would say in that period as well that he was highly successful. I've taken the gloves away from him, you know, and that's why I put him at the top, because that's where generally I saw him as the world-class player, the world-class batsman that he was for England during that period.
Yeah, it's interesting. Stewart had scored more runs than anyone else in the world in the 90s. And when you just include his performance at the top of the order, I think over the course of his career, he averaged 47 opening the batting. Dropped a little bit lower just in the 90s. So a formidable record at the top. John, who have you gone for?
So it's a very good case for Stewart, and I feel slightly shamefaced not having picked him, particularly in present company. But I went for Graham Gooch and Saeed Anwar. Graham Gooch played only the first half of the 90s and, you know, was at towards the end of his career, as we know. But I think, you know, for a period in the early 90s, he was, you know, pretty much, you know, arguably the best batsman in the world, certainly one of the best, and certainly one of the best openers. He averaged 51 in the 90s, I believe. 45 tests, 4,000 runs, 1,200s. And that, you know, the 1990 series away in the West Indies, when he was captain, got injured partway through, remains one of the great, you know, England overseas performances against a really strong side, given where England were at the time. You've got his 3-3-3, and you've also got, you know, the 154 at Headingley and 91, which is, you know, routinely regarded as one of the great innings by an England batsman. Saeed Anwar, I mean, you know, Graham rightly talks about people getting on with it. Saeed Anwar, other than Jai Surya, Saeed Anwar scored quicker than any opener in the 90s. Scored 900s, averaged 48. I think played a belting innings at the Oval in, I'm guessing, 96. But there's one thing I came across while checking this out was that, so in Calcutta, February 1999 in Calcutta, which was basically the third test of a series, but it was actually part of the Asia Test Championship. Pakistan hadn't played on Indian soil for 13 years. He scored 188, carried his bat for 188 out of 316 in a game where no one else scored more than 79. Pakistan were 26 for 6 on the opening morning, all out for 185. And then he's basically his second inning score was more than their entire first inning score. It was, according to Wisden, it was the best attended test match in history. Whether that's been overtaken since, I doubt it, because basically 100,000 there every day until after two riots, the game was called off and it played out in front of no one. The first riot was when Sachin Tendulkar got run out, but yeah, so I've gone for, you know, right hand, left hand, Gooch to be solid and Anwar to slash it through point, I guess.
Phil?
Like that. So I've gone with the same as you here, John. I've gone with Gooch and Anwar as well. And yeah, Anwar became an irresistible choice for me, really. I remember that innings in 96, the one that you mentioned, 170-odd, I think it was, at the Oval. And I was actually at that game as a kid. So I remember watching that innings and it was staggering piece of work, really. And his record stands up. He averaged 46 as an opening bat during the decade, but it was the manner in which he got those runs as well. And you mentioned that 188. That was the game where Shoaib Akhtar cleaned up Dravid and Tendulkar 2-2 with two in-swinging Yorkers. It was just one of the great test matches, really, of the decade. And Anwar dominated that game, really. So, yeah, I've lent that way as well. And I've also gone with Gucci. Gooch kind of defined the early part of that decade, really, for me, as an England fan, becoming acquainted with the sort of uneven nature of this England team, that we'd go to Australia and get turned over and then we'd come back to England and then there'd be the shoots of recovery and so on, and then it would be two steps forward and one step back. But Gooch was that constant throughout, really. And to be in his late 30s and to have averaged 52 and a bit in that decade over, I've got it here, 45 games. So it's a significant sample size, really. And to have done it all while looking like he'd rather be anywhere else than opening the batting for England, and carrying that side against some serious attacks as well. I mean, you mentioned obviously the 150 at Headingley, Ambrose, Walsh, Patterson, etc., Marshall as well in that side. But also he made 100 as well against Pakistan the following year, Wazi, Waka, Mushtaq as well. And then made 100 in 93, Graham's debut series as well. He made 100 before punching one off his off stump for a handled ball at Old Trafford. That was against Warne and the like. So he was getting big runs, but big runs against all-time attacks, serious attacks. So yeah, I couldn't really resist those two. I've gone with those. Graham, just to come back to your bid to put Sachin up top.
Understand, gentlemen, I am changing the goalposts a little bit here.
Right.
Based on actually being on the park with some of these people. So I didn't want to delve too closely into just the stats. And that's probably why I'm the anomaly here around the table tonight. And I thought, I have to get Sachin into my team because he was a brilliant technician. He would, if I told you the best players I played against in my era were Lara, Tendulkar, Ponting, Callis and Steve Waugh. They were the five best players I played against on a cricket field, really, as batsmen. And so that's why I within my team selection, I've looked at the stats and then I've tried to just apply what I saw on the cricket field. Even though I know in the 90s, some of their records hadn't quite developed into the players they became. So I had to find a place for Sachin and he had to go at the top for me. Because I believe that he would do the job with it as a great technician. We're being different selectors around the table here.
Would he do the job at all, though, Graham? I mean, it's quite a big call to say, Sachin, sorry, mate. If we're, you know, playing against some of the great fast bowlers of the era, if you could just go up top, mate.
Well, this is PlayStation selection, so.
I reckon no, right? I mean, one thing we can surely agree on is that Sachin makes our team. He makes our team somewhere.
He sneaks in.
You don't always want selectors to agree.
Indeed. That wouldn't be fun at all.
I think we'll definitely find space for Sachin going down. I mean, just Graham, quickly on Gooch. The England team that you came into had Gooch in that era. What was he like to share a dressing with as a youngster?
Yeah, so I mean, on my debut, obviously 1993, the Australia Trent Bridge. You know, that I got a 100, and I batted with Gooch in the second innings, and he got 100 as well. I always say to people nowadays when people get hundreds, there's helmets off, there's hugging, you know, there's everything going on. I can remember Graham Gooch got his 100, and I was batting with him at the time, and I went down there, and he kind of raised his bat, you know, kind of, there was no histrionics at all with him, and I just shook his hand, you know, and that was it. And I can remember when I got my 100 in the second innings, Nasser was batting with me, who I'd obviously played a lot of cricket with as a youngster coming through. I can remember I took my helmet off and I grabbed Nasser. You know, I've got a picture in my loo, with Nasser on my debut, and I'm grabbing him, you know, around his neck. You know, and that was probably the difference. But look, so with Gucci for me, And then I toured in 94 with him, you know, to Australia, where probably his powers were fading a little bit. And so Gucci and Gat were retired on that 94 tour, which was my first Ashes tour to Australia. So I know he's a great, but I tried to just put my own blend on it around the players, which I probably saw in front of me all the time doing really well.
We've got to make a decision, unfortunately, with presuming that Sachin gets in the side in the middle order. We need to pick two of Stuart, Gooch and Syed Anwar. Over to you guys.
Well, I can absolutely see the case for Alex Stewart opening the batting for England and for this World 11. As you said, yes, he scored more runs in this decade than any other player alive. If he hadn't been, in some respects, a victim of his own brilliance and his own versatility and taking the gloves on, then he could have been one of England's all-time great opening batsmen. The record is there, in those double hundred, the twin hundreds in Barbados, with Graham chipping in with an 80-odd, I think, in one of the innings as well, back at the second innings, I think it might have been.
Yeah.
He showed against the greats that he could pull it off, Alex Stewart, absolutely. And Gooch... Maybe there's an element of sentimentality in there with me. I mean, I'm an Essex boy, and I was at the at Lords when he made the triple and so on as a kid. But Stewart's record across the decade itself probably makes a pretty persuasive case to slip him in there. I'm going to go out to bat for Anwar because he's one of the dreamboat lefties that I've ever seen. And I like to mix it up with the nationalities as much as possible as well. And I think I like Anwar in there as a southpaw opening bat, but I can hear for Stuart. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I'm persuaded. I mean, I'm slightly embarrassed, and this is prejudice. It's probably, you know, anti-Surrey prejudice. I'm a Middlesex man, anti-Chelsea prejudice. I'm a West Ham fan, so hence the Gooch thing. I don't know. So, you know, it's confessional here now, you know, in front of Graham. But yeah, so I'll be honest, I kind of sidelined Stuart, and then I sort of came back to it, and, you know, Six and a half thousand runs across the period that we are talking, scored more runs, as you say, than any person in the decade. That's a pretty and against decent bowlers, for goodness sake. So yeah, and Gooch, yeah, I mean, we're talking about specifics and we're talking about half a decade. So yeah, I'm with you, Phil, there that Stewie can very much get in. And the point you make is right, that, you know, he batted in different places, gloves, not gloves, whatever. And if he'd just been that opening batsman, then who knows? And it's easy to sort of overlook the way in which he took the attack to bowlers now, because we're so used to seeing batsmen, whatever number they're batting, particularly openers, going at it. It was a big deal for him to be going at it with, you know, when it wasn't easy. And there were players who, you know, whether it's Graham, Nasser, Ramps, whatever, who maybe felt constrained at certain points, and Stewie was out there, you know, smashing it.
I'm glad you conceded on that run for me, gentlemen. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, Alec was a big influence on my career with the way how positive he was as a player. You know, he would talk to me about how quickly you could try to get on top of a good bowler. He said, good bowlers will not bowl you just randomly bad deliveries. You know, you have to find a way within your technique of putting pressure on them. So he was a big influence for me, obviously, as a, you know, being in the Surrey dressing room with him, and then, you know, obviously being younger than him and then playing for England with him. We were different in characters, don't get me wrong, but I learned a hell of a lot from him about how he went about his business as a guy, the way he practiced and the way actually on the pitch. He always tried to take a positive attitude out to score runs against them. So thank you, lads. I'm sure I'm gonna lose my other opener here, though.
I think we're gonna go Stuart and Anwar up top. Moving on okay. to the middle order, you all picked Sachin, Lara, and Steve Waugh in your 11s. So we won't dwell too long on those three. Before we started recording, John reminded me, Graham, that you and Daryl Hare were the only two people other than Lara himself to be on the field for both Lara's 375 and Lara's 400. So just a question on that. What did you feel when you shared a field with Lara? What was he like to watch up close?
Well, similar to someone like Alec, who was obviously, you know, from the same county and the same country, Brian Lara had massive influence on me as well. Having been on a cricket field with him, and it was on that first tour when I went to the West Indies in '93. You might remember I was bowled in the first four innings. I was bowled twice in Jamaica and twice in Guyana by the West Indian bowlers. And I can remember Geoffrey Boycott came up to me in the hotel after the match in Guyana. And he said to me, he said, you need to watch how Lara bats. He said, you know, you're static, you're a robot. Right, he was very critical, which actually it hurt me a little bit. But I remember I went back to my hotel room, and I thought he's got a point. He's absolutely right. And I can remember I went into the nets at Trinidad, which was the third Test match, and I decided I'd try to bat like Lara in the nets, you know, and I'd watched him play. I've been on the same park with Lara, and I just was, you know, completely taken away by a guy. And Angus Fraser and our bowlers would say, that wasn't a bad delivery I bowled to him. And he'd slice it for four through backward point because of his high bat lift, his foot movement. And if you bowled short, he just hit it off his hip. And if you pitched it up, he drove it down. So he had a technique which, if you did not hit what I say to our cricketers now, if you don't hit the saucepan, you know, or the little plate, right? The best batsman in the world will score off you. And that's what I learned from watching Lara bat. So, he was somebody who had a massive influence on me as a player. And I tried to copy him. I took little bits from him. And then I tried to mold it back into what I was as a player. So, Brian Lara probably scored more runs, you know, against England when I was playing them than any other player. And he got obviously 400, he got a 300, he got a few doubles, he got plenty of centuries. And I loved watching him bat. And he would probably be my, of all the players I played against, is the number one player, the number one batsman.
He was the first name on my sheet. The 90s began really with Lara at Sydney against a young Warne in 91, and he made 277 at Sydney, and that was his first Test 100, Lara's. Richie Beno said at the time that it was the best sustained display of hitting he'd seen since Sobers. And from that moment on, he dominated the decade, really, and he did it against the big lot. He did it against Australia at the start and at the end of that decade. And while there were some internal issues within the West Indies setup, and he wasn't much of a captain by all accounts, and he could be slightly surly and maybe a little bit insular at times. When he was on it, there was just no one else like him, and that series against a rampant Australia side in 99, when he made a double at Jamaica, a quick 100 at Antigua in 70 balls or something, and obviously the famous 153 not out to win that game at Barbados on his own. They were nine down chasing 300 and he got the lot. And he dominated that Australian side, full-strength Australian side, and he did it on his own. No other player really in the decade had that ability to take a series and bend it to his own will, I think. And then the style, of course. It all adds up. So Lara at three, for me, was comfortably the first name on the sheet.
And quickly, we don't need to talk about them for that long, but Sachin's record was obviously absolutely incredible over the course of the 90s. Scored 5,600 runs at 58, 2,200s, four more than anyone else. And Steve Waugh, 6,200 runs at 53, 1,800s. As I said, all three of you picked those three. But this is where it does get quite tricky. We need to find one more middle order batsman. And between you guys, you came up with a lot of different names, actually. So let's start with John. John, who would you most like to join Sachin, Steve Waugh, and Lara in that middle order?
Well, I picked Mark Waugh, actually, and which slightly surprised me in a way, because I guess he partly suffers by comparison with his brother, but I mean, he scored 1,400s at number four, obviously one of the greatest slippers of all time, averaged 40 in the West Indies. He scored 5,000 runs at number four. No one scored more in that position over the course of the decade. And, you know, Phil mentioned the style of Lara. I'm with these kind of things, I'm a bit of a sucker for a bit of style and a bit of flair as well, even though it's not like we're short of it. But I went for Mark Waugh. I mean, you know, because I didn't have Alec at the top, I mean, Stuart would have been another option. Azharuddin is an option, but I've decided not to go down that route for reasons perhaps we don't need to go into. And Aravinda De Silva is kind of knocking around as well. But I went for Mark Waugh. I mean, you know, he was clearly, you know, had his ups and downs, but and I think he got five ducks in Sri Lanka during the 90s, averaged nine or something, you know, four on the bounce or whatever. So, yeah, you could hardly call him Mr. Consistent. The other one I just throw in the mix, so actually was for a number three option, was David Boone, actually, 1,200s at number three. But, you know, and again, just a great character, great, you know, scored a lot of runs against England. But, yeah, unfortunately, Booney loses out against some all-timers. But, yeah, Mark Waugh was my pick.
Phil, you didn't pick Mark Waugh, which I was quite surprised by.
Well, yeah, I went with his brother because I thought we needed a captain of this side. And I thought that Steve Waugh would probably be the only one who would have balls big enough to tell people what to do in this team of egos and powerhouse cricketers. But I was very tempted by Mark Waugh. And what's interesting about the comparison between the two, John, you say that he maybe suffered by comparison with his brother, but the records are a lot more similar than I maybe thought as well. Mark Waugh passed 50, and I don't want to kind of go down a stats rabbit hole here, but Mark Waugh passed 50 54 times in the 90s, and Steve Waugh passed 50 46 times in the 90s. What the difference is that Steve Waugh made it count. Steve Waugh was not out 160s, 170s, a double 100 at Headingley in that terrible test match in 93. He used to grind home and make sure he had the red inker at the end. Whereas Mark Waugh would come in, charm the pants off you for a couple of hours, get a 70 or an 80 odd, and then nick off to slip. That's my kind of cricketer, far more than Steve. But we needed a captain, so I went with Steve Waugh, but only really by a whisker. Mark Waugh is obviously a dreamboat of a batsman. I think everybody knows that. But the numbers are there too, and he would make important runs. He made a brilliant fourth innings 100 against South Africa as well at Cape Town, and always got runs against us, always seemed to get runs against us. And as you say, probably the best second slip, maybe him and Callis, that I've ever seen. So it was very, very tight. But in the end, I left Mark Waugh on the bench and I went with Aravinda. You mentioned him. I went with Aravinda at five, actually, with Steve Waugh at six. Aravinda, what, 4.5 feet? No more than that. And he could pull and hook good length balls wherever he went. Aravinda made 600s against Pakistan and 500s against India. I mean, we didn't really play Sri Lanka. You know, such was our kind of attitude, I suppose, or the suits administrators' attitudes at the time to Sri Lankan cricket. But not only did he win a World Cup, obviously, in one-day cricket, but that number of runs, 1100s against the big two Asian sides, averaged 47 through the 90s and did it with a unique kind of technique and a unique kind of style. He'd, you know, he'd hold the bat with a massive gap between the hands. The pickup would be perpendicular to the body, and he was just a phenomenal player to watch, a unique player for me to watch. And the numbers are also there. Plus, I wanted a Sri Lankan in there. I wanted to sex it up as much as possible. What have you got, Graham?
Those arguments which you're saying. So my the bit where I changed the goalposts were, obviously, I had Ponting in because I was influenced by Ponting. I thought he was an incredible player. You know, a great hunger for scoring runs. So my brackets was because Callis to me was a colossal. He was a colossus of a player for me. You know, once he got in, so very similar, very different to Mark Waugh. So having played and knew Mark Waugh's character quite well, Mark Waugh would be, well, once I've got 100, yeah, what else is there to do? You know. Steve Waugh and Jack Callis's view would be, well, we make sure that we grind the opposition in. You know, whereas Mark Waugh would go, I've got 100 now, it's time to, you know, just tee off and entertain, you know, and then, you know, go and have a little bet on the horses and go and enjoy a nice tea, you know. And that was the beauty of someone watching Mark Waugh bat. He was beautifully, you know, balanced, he was graceful, he was a great timer of the ball. But the other two just churned out runs. And so being on the park with them, you knew once these guys got in, Callis and Steve Waugh were potentially going to change that test match and make life hell for you. So that was my tricky bit, obviously, because when I looked at the stats, Jack Callis was actually on the bowling stats low down in the 90s, but he wasn't even on the batting stats in the 90s. And I was quite surprised by that because he made his debut in Cape Town. I remember in that test match where we lost in Cape Town, that's where he made his debut in 1994, I think. And I was surprised thinking, well, another 6 years went by and he wasn't even on, well, I don't know how many players were on that list, 50 maybe. I was statistically challenged by the fact that Callis wasn't there, but when you look at him and whatever he averaged by the end of his career, and you look at him as a cricketer and he got 290 odd test wickets, you know, 13,000 test runs, average 55. You know, I struggled to put Mark Waugh above Jack Callis into my batting order. But if you are going stat based, then I am going to have to concede to you guys on this one. And you can have your pick on that position. As you may well have your pick on Ponting as well. But obviously, as you say, we agree with Tendulkar, Lara, Waugh. You've given us Stewart at the top. I think I'm getting 4 out of 6 of my selections in.
Yeah, you'll take that. What about Aravinda then, Graham? What do you think about Aravinda?
Great player. I listened to exactly what you said, and I know he's very high up in the 90s on his stats. Brilliant player of spin and a very good player of fast bowling. So If you want to go stats and Callis is not in there and Mark Waugh's not in there, then I would go with Aravinda.
Yeah, just on Callis. So Callis only played 32 tests in the 90s. And in lockdown one, we picked a test team of the 2000s. And rest assured, Callis was in that one, as was Ponting.
Yeah.
So they'll go to sleep easy if we don't include him in this one.
Sorry, yes, just on Ponting as well, just to finish off on that. Okay. He played 33 games in the decade and probably the turn of the century was when he really became that top, top, top world-class player. and the most uncompromising player of his generation. Before that, he was a little bit in and out of that side. And he made 100 in the 97 Ashes, Graham, which I think you'll probably remember. Yeah. Before that,
yeah.
I think it was maybe in the fourth test, but before that, he was struggling for runs a little bit. And, you know, he was batting at six in that side, up and down the order a little bit. And he had one or two off-field things going on as well. So it wasn't really until the turn of the century where he really became the monster player that we obviously know that he was. He averaged 44 in the 90s. If it was 1990 to 2002, then he's in. He's in a heartbeat. But I think the cut-off...
So at the moment, we're going Stewart. Who's the other opener?
Anwar.
And then who are you putting at three now then? Lara?
Yep.
Lara, Sachin.
Steve
Waugh. Steve Waugh's going to be in there. Steve Waugh, and then whoever is your number six. So you're going to go Aravinda.
I think Aravinda gets the nod.
And I concede.
Moving on to the keeper. So two of you chose Ian Healy, but John, you didn't. You chose Andy Flower, which I thought was quite interesting because when we were picking the ODI side of the decade for Wisden.com earlier in the week, there weren't really anyone who stood out with a brilliant record with the gloves, with the bat. Who could also keep. But then we realise, is that okay in the 90s because keepers weren't judged quite as much on their batting then. Do you think Flower's case with the bat was just too strong to ignore?
Well, this is a slightly sort of obtuse pick in the sense, you know, Healy played 102 tests in the 90s. And in terms of keepers, the next is Alec with 42. So it's kind of no contest really, but Flower played 35 tests, scored 2,500 runs at 44, 600s and 1450s. He scored some big hundreds. He didn't, you know, fair play, he didn't play against Australia or West Indies, but that's kind of not his fault. I just sort of thought, I've got a soft spot for Flower. I think he's just, you know, in a playing for Zimbabwe, he was a proper, you know, international class player in a kind of very obviously modest emerging side. So, I'll be honest, I can't really vouch for his keeping, and keeping to our spinner, who we can probably guess who that might be, but whoever it might be, would might be a challenge for anybody, but maybe for someone like Flower, I don't know, probably keep all the time either. He makes a decent case, but yeah, I mean, Healy as a keeper and in terms of longevity and all the rest of it, but I mean, as a batter, I mean, Healy was a very useful batter, but I'd say he's more, you know, he's probably more of an eight than a seven, really, if you're being honest. And it's not, I mean, crikey, it's not like we're short of batting in this team, but yeah, Flower, that was my, you know, that's my manifesto for Andy Flower's inclusion.
Graham, for people who've not watched Ian Healy play live, just how good a keeper was he? Because there'll be people who just look at his numbers and go, Why is he issuing?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ian Healy has said his two best stumpings were both off me when I was batting. one was at Edgbaston when I was a bit of a greenhorn. And actually, the story behind that was that Steve Waugh was at Silly Point. It's the only time I've been out-sledged on a cricket pitch. And I said to myself when I was walking off, that's never going to happen again. We were eight down. I was batting with Martin Becknell. I was 60 not out. And Ian Healy turned around to Steve Waugh, who was at Silly Point. He said, watch this little prick play for a red inker. And I charged out of my crease, trying to hit one for six. And it obviously I missed it. It hit the rough and it was a great take. And Healy took that one. I think the other one may have been at Perth, where I was trying to hit one again out of Perth after I got to... I was having my Mark Waugh moment. I've got 120 on the board and I'm thinking, right, now's the time to take the blonde lad down. And it's a very similar thing. Massive bounce on the ball. Healy took two great stumpings, which I think I've heard him talk about on a TV show before. You're right. I mean, I understand the Flower argument with the batting and probably Healy under average under 30 believe in his test career, but as a selector I've just gone for the out and out wicket keeper in that generation, so I've gone quite old school on that, and he was a great character as well. Very funny. I mean, there was an incident where I was in Brisbane and I went to sweep the ball, and Glenn McGrath was at short fine leg at the time. And I went to sweep the ball and I missed it. And Ian Healy's shouted to McGrath at short fine leg, "Get it, pigeon, get it, get it." I've nearly set off for a single. Little did I know that the ball is in Ian Healy's hands, who's taken it down the leg side. And I turned round to Healy and go, I said, "You wouldn't, would you?" He said, "Try me, mate." Yeah. And, so he was a great character, and he was one of those Aussies in the 90s. There was a handful of them, you know. If we did well against Australia in that period, they were forthcoming with a pack of six into your dressing room and share a beer and chat the game over, which was great. They weren't all like that, but a few of them were.
Well, I think Healy makes our 11 then.
Sorry, on the subject of keepers, yeah. Can I just throw in that Gilchrist played 5 tests in the 90s and averaged 60. It's sort of like, you know, even though this wasn't his era at all, and it was just, but he was on the move, you know.
So, I mean, I had him in, and then I realised, hold on, I looked at the stats and I went, no, hold on.
Before we go on to the bowlers, we've got a very exciting announcement from Wisden HQ this week. We are launching the Wisden Drinks Collection in the run-up to Christmas. We're selling a beer, rye, gin and vodka. Head to wisden.com/shop to see what you can get. Next week, we'll talk about the spirits in a bit of detail. But right now, because my batch arrived today, I'm going to quickly talk through the beers. So each Wisden Ale gift pack consists of 3 cans of The Little Wonder, an amber ale with a toffee and biscuit malt backbone with a delicate fruit aroma, and 3 cans of The Afternoon Session, a refreshing session pale ale that provides a citrus aroma. Each can has a profile on the back of it of a former Wisden Cricketer of the Year. The can I have here features Malcolm Marshall, who was the Wisden Cricketer of the Year in 1983. And each case also comes with 6 beer mats that also have a profile of a previous Wisden Cricketer of the Year on them. So I've got Shane Warne over here. I'm very excited. Phil, you're excited about these as well.
Oh, mate, I can barely contain myself. I'm drinking from the gaffer. I'm drinking from Alex Stewart himself. Right here and now, 1993, Wisden Cricketer of the Year. And he's in our team.
He'll be expecting a slice of that, won't he, I should imagine?
Moving swiftly on.
On to the bowlers. I think this is where it gets... This is where it gets really tough. I remember when we picked the side of the 2000s, there were loads of batsmen we talked about who averaged north of 50 in that decade, including yourself, Graham. This time round, we've got loads of bowlers who average just around 20. I know it's not all about averages, but you've got some of the all-time great bowlers in the history of the game in this era. So picking 4 is a real challenge. Graham, you actually faced the guy, so we'll start with you first. Which 3 seam bowlers did you pick?
Well, I've gone on, obviously, personal experience of facing them. And their records were good in that era as well. So I've gone Wazzy Makram. It's nice if you can get the left armer in there. And he was one of those guys who was quick. His action, it wasn't straightforward to pick up, and that made him a little bit harder as well. So there have been other quicks out there. For example, someone like Alan Donald was fast, but actually his action to pick up was easier than others. Whereas Akram would sort of scuttle up to the crease, very fast arm, good with the new ball, had the ability to hit you on the head, hit you on the toe, and knock your poles over as well. And then, and if the ball reversed, he was lethal. He was a lethal bowler, around or over the wicket, could change his angles. And I would have tried many different things against him, but I never ever felt that I felt comfortable with the crease against him. So on that reason alone, he was probably the first bowler down.
Hmm. And you also picked Curtly Ambrose as well, who John and picked.
Yeah, and actually at times between Ambrose and Walsh, I felt like I'd line Ambrose up, but he gave you very, very little. And if there was anything in the surface, he would get it out of the surface. And he just had the ability to, from a back of a length. Or, I mean, I reckon I played five series with Curtly Ambrose. He bowled me three half volleys, I reckon, in that time. I can remember all the drives down the ground off him. There were only three. And so he gave you very, very little. So you had to make that decision whether I'm as a batsman, am I going to drop and run? I'm going to have to line him up, or can I pull him? And you were having to occasionally make a premeditated decision against him that I'm going to go deeper in my crease and try to pull him and see if I can knock him off his guard a little bit. But he was very hard to knock off his guard. You know, he knew what it was all about, and he gave you very, very little as a fast bowler. So that's why he's in for me. So I had Akram, Ambrose. And then the other one was quite tricky because obviously Glenn McGrath was a fantastic bowler. But Sean Pollock, for me, being a left-hander, got very close to the stumps, had the ability to swing the ball probably more than McGrath. And he was equally as smart as McGrath as well in terms of working his batsman out. And I just struggled more against Sean Pollock than I did for Glenn McGrath. And so that's why that was one of those sort of personal choices where I went Pollock over McGrath, which might surprise some people.
It doesn't really surprise me. Pollock's record in the 90s was outrageous, really. And you mentioned Ambrose, you know, barely went at two runs and over. Pollock was the same. Their economy rates are comfortably below anyone else of the quicks at the time. Also, I always remember what Athers used to say. Pollock's bouncer was the toughest to face because it's kind of came out of nowhere. And he's not necessarily associated with being quick, but he was clearly quick enough.
He hit a lot of people. And I've heard sometimes, even, you know, when I talked to Ath, yeah, say about Archer, very similar, very close to the stumps at times, straight over the top and very little indicator that it's going to be a bouncer. And because obviously when Pollock first started his career, he was fast. You know, I can remember his debut test match where I think I was his first wicket, but he hit Robin Smith on the head three times
right.
at Pretoria. And Robin didn't get hit that much, really, on the head. And he hit him three times on the head. And Robin came in at lunchtime. He said, "How's this?" Well, I won't swear because we're on it, but "How's this little so-and-so, you know, kind of hit me on the head three times?" But that was his action. He was close to stumps. Any movement. That's why I had him in for me.
Mm. John, who do you go for?
Well, just before that, I was speaking to John Snow recently for the next edition of Wisden Cricket Monthly, and we were talking about the notion of pace and sort of whether English fast bowlers are, you know, whether we have developed or, you know, been receptive enough to quick bowlers over the years. And he said, you know, it's not about pace. You've got to be fast enough, which is a comment that, you know, we've heard tonight as well. And the thing about Archer is right. It's not, you know, there's no point being fast for the hell of it. You know, it's, and you mentioned earlier, Graham, about the accuracy of these bowlers that we're talking about. The other thing, again, sorry, yes, just I'll tell you who I picked, but you know, we're leaving a bunch of blokes on the bench here who are kind of world-class all-time bowlers. And I think, you know, one of the things that made the 90s a golden era for Test cricket was the quality of these fast bowling attacks around the world. The spin bowling, obviously there's some greats in there, but it's not a very deep list, but the quicks, unbelievable. Initially I picked Donald, and then in the end I picked Wacker. I mean, I don't know. It's choose your poison, isn't it? Really, but he got more tenfers than anyone else. I mean, five for what it's worth. But it's just, you know, if you the variation, the old ball ability as well. I don't know. I just in the end went for him. You know, Wazim, Curtly, and Wacker seem like a pretty good mix to me. But yeah, Donald's clearly an option as well. I didn't actually consider Pollock really, but. You know, possibly again, I'm thinking of him as a different era or the next decade. But yeah, I went for Wacker. And I guess, Graham, you'd have faced Wacker, you know, been on the same team as him as well, I guess, as well.
I did. And It was hard, but again, my personal experience of playing against Waka was he was more lethal to right-handers than he was to left-handers.
Yeah.
So so Waka got me out twice with the new ball, but he never got me out with the old ball, whereas Wazim would get me out with the old ball because Waka could not reverse swing the ball back into a left-hander. Mm-hmm. He could hold it up. And I just found the other three at a different level. So I know there is very much a bit of a personal experience of playing against those guys who I felt put me under more pressure technically as a batsman. And you're right, there were a hell of a lot of bowlers. You're talking about Courtney Walsh, Alan Donald, Waka Yunus, even someone like, I don't know where Srinath was in the 90s, Indian quick as well. Yeah. And there would have been, yeah, Glenn McGrath sitting on the sidelines, quite a tricky one to leave out as well. So I think if we agree on two, Akram and Ambrose, you can argue about Pollock, but...
Well, all right, I'll step in here. For me, it was a toss-up between Pollock and Waka, and I went with Waka because, you know, it's a bit more thrilling, I suppose, but... Who are we to step in and say to you, Graham, that no, sorry, mate, you're not going to have Pollock in your team, you're going to have Waka when you've actually faced them from 22 yards? So I think we can all just sit back on this one and go with Pollock, who's, as I say, his record is outrageous. Just to be slightly cheeky, if you had to put in an England quick from the 90s into this side, who would it be?
Probably Gough, based on when he was quick, he would have been of our closest to Waka Yunus. So good with the new ball, quick enough. As Goughy would say, he may have benefited from the sports science era of the 2010 onwards with England. But when he was at his best, he had that bullish belief as a cricketer, that he could do anything on a cricket field. And when he was at his best, he would get the best players out for you as well.
Pollock it is. John, are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, very much so.
Done. Okay, so it's Wazim, Ambrose and Pollock.
And it's another nationality in the mix as well.
Yeah, all true. We're not going to get any grief here on social media. We're covered in more.
Not much.
Very good.
Direct all problems to @Phil_Wisdom. The last spot on the team was again one that was unanimous. You all picked Shane Warne over Murali and Kumble. Graham, I guess, so it's not really a debate about whether he's inside, but just again, just to hear your experiences of facing arguably the greatest bowler of all time.
Well, I've often spoken about Shane in a way that he was a great competitor to start with. I mean, when I played against him in 93, you have to remember I didn't play him like a lot of other players did after that, where he's Shane Warne. When I first played against him, I just thought, who's this bloke with blonde hair, you know, got a lot of gob on him, you know, but actually could land the ball consistently in the same place and do it from a different angle on the crease. Variations, had a top spinner, never a great googly, but could lower his arm, you know, and he could keep delivering the ball into an area where he didn't give you a lot to hit. You had to come up with something. So the best bowlers in the world, batsmen have to come up with something where they can put pressure onto great bowlers. And but I never played the man ever. With Shane, because probably I was a very similar age to him coming through. So he was a great competitor. I think Shane would tell you over a beer, even talking to me, he would say, I could read exactly where you're at within about 10 balls of bowling at you. Whether you felt confident, whether you're going to sweep me, whether you're going to take me on, whether you're going to be slightly more defensive, what language I could use against you. You know, as well, whether I could be kind of a bit smart and tell you, you've never hit me through extra cover in two series. So why do I need an extra cover? And then he'd throw up a big, leggy outside leg stump, off stump, and see whether you'd actually drive it. So he was the all-round package, for me. He was probably the player, if you said, if we could have one Australian playing for England in that period, I would have said, oh, we'll take Shane Warne, Whether the Aussies would have played him differently, I don't know. But those are my experiences for him, and loved the game. Was if you did well against him, he'd be another guy who would be happy to come and sit, have a beer with you, tell you well played. That was a great knock. I come back to what I said earlier about the accuracy of a bowler. Astonishing that I can probably, again, like with Ambrose, count the amount of long hops he bowled me in about four or five series. And I reckon there was probably two or three. The rest you had to kind of find a way of putting pressure on him.
Brilliant. The impression of leg spinners before Warne, or the impression, the bit like with sort of English quick bowlers or whatever, it's assumed that, well, they'll give you, they'll bowl a four ball and over, and that's just the way leg spinners are. But he completely debunked that notion, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And there was very rarely, there was a fizz actually batting against him. There was a fizz. You heard it come out of his hand. And that was the thing which was, which I noticed when I first played against him, that snap as the ball came out of his hand. As many people would say, a rare and unique cricketer. I felt, in a way, looking at the bowlers in that era, I always felt very honoured, actually, with the era which I played in against some of these bowlers because, their records are phenomenal. You're talking about guys who average 20, 21, in Test cricket, having played over 100 Test matches. It's quite astonishing, really, to have that level of longevity and consistent high performance, as a cricketer, And I considered myself, I gave it a fair crack, but I look at some of these guys and I just think they were on a different level, as cricketers. But they would have it didn't happen by fluke, They work bloody hard at their games as well. They had to have done.
We have an 11. It is some 11. I'll run through it quickly. Alex Stewart, Syed Anwar, Brian Lara, Sachin Tendulkar, Steve Waugh, who I think we agree is captain. Aravindra Kumar, Ian Healy, Sean Pollock, Wazim Akram, Shane Warne, and Kirtley Ambrose. That is some 11. Thank you very much, all three of you. Graham, it's been a genuine pleasure having you on. Thanks for taking some time out of your tour and best of luck with that tour. Thanks, John. Thanks, Phil. Listeners, if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends. And if you're feeling especially kind, why don't leave us a 5-star review on the podcast app. Cheers.